This is Back to Back.
Yo, what's up, Back to Backers? This is Willie Joy. Welcome to the show. This is Back to Back. This is my podcast. How are you? How you doing? How you feeling? It's nice to be back with you. Nice to get that little jolt of human connection that I get to have with everyone here every week. You know, we go down plenty of rabbit holes on this podcast, and sometimes maybe the point gets muddled. But we're here because we're trying to get to the bottom of this thing we all love. And man, I am glad to be on this journey with all of you. This week, we've got a great episode. Speaking of people who are just trying to figure it out, I've got Clayton Blaha on the show. Clayton Blaha was one of the co-founders of Ausla Records, currently the head of artist relations and partnerships over at Audius. If you listen to this podcast in the last year, you've probably heard Audius come up. You know, the exciting new music platform. They just hit a benchmark of over 5 million monthly active users, which is huge. There's a ton of big names involved on the platform already. And I'm going to put a link in the description of this episode where you can go check out Audius, see what they're all about, and maybe you too can go get involved. Clayton and I recorded this conversation live on Twitch, which if you haven't checked in with the podcast in a while, I am recording all these episodes live in front of your eyes these days. So in the description of this episode, you're going to find another link to my Twitch channel. Go follow me there so you'll get notified every time I go live. I'm doing a podcast a week, sometimes two on there. I'm doing DJ sets. I'm doing a stream on Fridays with one of my best friends who happens to be an incredible comedian. We are listening to your demos, to your whips. If you are a music producer, you can come submit music on my Discord and we will listen to it live on stream every single Friday. The show is called Do It Bang. So I always get asked, you know, how can I get people to listen to my stuff? How can I get feedback? We're here every single Friday. So come send me your music. I'd love to hear it. We will address any concerns you have. And just in general, it is such a fun time, those Friday streams. So look, there's a lot going on my Twitch channel, y'all. So throw me the follow there. It's twitch.tv/WillieJoy. Come through when I'm recording these podcasts. Ask questions to your favorite artists and I will force them to answer your questions. No, look, it's a blast. And I'm really having a great time recording these podcasts with all of you guys sitting in the room, sitting in the chat, and we're all doing it together. So that's all I got to say about that. Today is all about Clayton, though. Clayton Blaha, I first knew him when he first moved to Chicago. Those days, he was working for Biz3, one of the premier publicity companies in the country. And Clayton has really done it all, from PR, publicity, to running a label with Ausla, to artist management. He's managed artists all over the spectrum, genre-wise. You'll hear him talk about a singer named Matt Mason, who he's currently managing. And of course, his current position over at Audius, as well as a whole bunch of other activities. Clayton's always working on something. And it was a really fascinating chat. I'm really glad we got to catch up. It had been a while. It had really been a while. And I think for you, the listener, there's a lot to pick out of this because Clayton, he's somebody behind the scenes, but the work he's doing has giant implications for the industry, for artists, for really anyone who loves music and loves what we all do, which is ostensibly why we're all here and why you're listening to me talk right now. So I really think you're going to enjoy this episode. I really did. Clayton is the best. If you do enjoy it, I would love to hear from you. You can always hit me up on social media at Willie Joy, at Back to Back Pod. And if you would like to support this show, the best way to show that support, well, first of all, it's coming through following me on Twitch and hanging out as I do these shows live in front of your eyes. But another great way to support Back to Back, to support what I'm doing over here, is just to spread the word. Word of mouth really is still, 4.5 years in, it's still how this show grows. The formula has not changed, and I owe a lot of the success of this show to the support of this amazing community, to your support. So anytime you're tagging us in your stories, anytime you're putting up a tweet, letting people know they should listen, anytime you're telling your friends to check it out, recommending a favorite episode, telling one of your favorite artists they should come on the show, all of that goes into making this show what it is. And I appreciate each and every one of you. You guys are the best. The back-to-back community is the best. And I will go to my grave saying that. So look, with all of that in mind, let's get into today's episode. This is a good one, guys. Get ready. This is me and Clayton Blaha, back to back. Let's go. Yeah, yeah, it's not great, man. Not great at all. I mean, it's funny because I saw just from social media that you had been in Mexico for a while. And I think when I first DM'd you a month ago or so, you were in New York where you are now. Are you based anywhere right now? Like, do you have a home?
not currently. Okay. I've been professionally house sitting for the last 3 months, which has been a very virtuous situation. We're a remote team now. In the pandemic, I was in LA, so I was the only remote employee anyway, when Audius got kicked off, and then everybody else was in San Francisco. And then so I got used to working from home pretty early. And then after obviously we all went into lockdown, we found that we were just so much more productive remote. There's more hours a day, better work-life balance if you're able to leave the house. And just generally, we're so in sync. We're a pretty tight team. We're really small still, which is also a blessing that we've been able to do this much with under 20 people.
Wow, I didn't know it was under 20 people.
Not anymore. I mean, I think it's 21 as of today, and we're constantly hiring. But for the gross majority of the pandemic, we were really a very small team. And I kind of just looked at LA and was like, I don't like this. and then it was in August, and everything started to open back up, and I was like, I'll go to Mexico, cause it was opening back up too. And I was like, it looked like everything was going to be, fine and dandy. And then it just didn't. And I didn't want to be traveling back and forth. So I just stayed there for a year.
Yeah.
But I could conceivably live anywhere on earth, but being that I'm in the relationships and communications game, time zones kind of make it, tenuous, so I maintain some sort of semblance of, sanity. So probably going to stick the American time zones, but conceivably could dip out and stay productive.
I mean, are you comfortable on the move like that, just in general? Because I know you've lived a whole bunch of different places in your life, and we'll get into all of that. But even just now, if I put myself in your shoes in that position, not knowing where I was going to live, that would stress me out personally.
Yeah, it was fun at first, and like you mentioned, I am from Boise, Idaho, but I've lived in San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, and spent a lot of time, in Europe. So I'm kind of used to I enjoy it at first, but now I'm to the point, in personally where I'm also 36 years old, yeah. If I'm going to, if I'm going to have a idyllic, American life, it's time to start taking that a little bit more seriously. It is stressful for sure. And I'm kind of at the point at where I'm over it. I really want to even though I've lived in many cities, when I go to those cities, I really establishing my team, my barber, my tailor, the barista, I like having all of those things. And you can establish that pretty quickly, but it's I like having neighbors. I like having community. Yeah. And things like that. It's possible digitally, but it's not necessarily the same. So yeah, I'm looking forward to settling in a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's for me, man, it's funny because what you're saying, on this podcast, I talk to plenty of producers and DJs and that sort of thing. And it's the same thing for people who live that tour life and are on the road all the time. What you just said is exactly what they say. It's like, well, every city, I got to have my, I got my coffee spot. I got the restaurant I go to dinner at. And it's funny how when you sort of jump into these romantic things, at least for me, when I was a kid, that seemed like a romantic idea of you're just always on the move, a different city every night. But then when you break it down, when you're actually doing that life, it's oh no, I kind of just want to do the same thing I did last time when I was here.
Yeah. And also, like, I think maybe notoriously, like, for somebody who's been around so many musicians for so long that have played, you know, 300 shows a year in some cases, I never went on tour and I will never go on tour. I don't enjoy the idea of touring. And I kind of went on tour accident recently. Like, you know, it was never like my intention. I wanted to stay pretty remote, but I mean, pretty like, you know,
yeah,
static in some place, but it just didn't really pan out. And so like, yeah, I'm over it, but you know, at least I got out of my system. And I do think that, I made amazing friends. Well, you know, I have amazing friends in every city, which does make it easier to leave.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's fair. I mean, did you move around a lot as a kid? Like, when did this wanderlust thing start happening?
I didn't actually. I've always wanted to live in New York since I was obsessed with Ninja Turtles. My parents tell me stories about when I was a little kid, and I would talk about living in the city because when I was really little, I was born in Arizona, and then I lived in the Central Coast of California until I was like seven. And when I was a really little kid, I was like super, super fascinated by graffiti, by hip hop, by, you know, what was happening in Los Angeles. Like, some of my earliest musical memories are of listening to Snoop Dogg and watching Snoop Dogg videos.
How was that reaching you, out of curiosity? Was it just on TV? Was it friends?
MTV. My parents let me watch MTV, which was, you know, a pretty formative decision for them, and the radio. But yeah, I remember the Rodney King riots like distinctly. And I remember being really, really upset about it when I was a very little kid. And I was just always fascinated by the city. But then my parents are the exact opposite. I mean, they like love, if it was up to them, they would live on, well, my mom. But when I was growing up, they had very, very real ambitions of living on like a farm. Like, they were very rurally minded.
Interesting.
We were going to move to Idaho one way or the other because my parents had like friends and family there. And they wanted to live like way out in the country. And I, upon hearing that, like burst into tears. And so they settled on Boise, Idaho, which is a small city, but a city nonetheless.
Yeah, it seems like a good compromise. I mean, it's definitely, you know, still farm vibes in Boise, I feel like.
For sure. I mean, it's definitely like outdoorsy for sure. Luckily, they had one of the first, like, I wouldn't say one of the first. Yeah, I'd probably say one of the first skate parks outside of California that anybody like took seriously in any capacity. Like, it was actually like a really well thought out, well planned skate park. And that pretty much saved my life, honestly. If it wasn't for skateboarding and my friends there and spending time there when I was a little kid, I probably would have gotten into a lot more trouble than I got into, which was a considerable amount of trouble anyway. But like, yeah, I mean, skateboarding for me was the only thing. And skateboarding is how I really got into music and how I kind of began to like explore the idea of working in music professionally. And then also like, you know, the earliest days of music tech, peer-to-peer stuff, like, was just kind of fell into my lap really early. And I was really like compelled by it and excited by it and kind of started there. Awesome. I just spilled water all over myself.
Oh, great. Great.
This is so funny that you're live streaming me spilling water.
I love this. Yeah.
I mean, seeing what's happened with musicians in the pandemic with Twitch is one of the more, gives me a little bit of hope for the future of this industry.
I mean, you want to talk about community, like you brought up the word community earlier. It's yeah. Wild to me how quickly a very big community grew around this in the pandemic.
Yeah, it's been so crazy to see and so cool. And like, also like, we identified it like in terms of audience, the team kind of like zoomed out a little bit as soon as we went into lockdown. And just, I mean, I'm always obviously kind of plugged into what's happening, but it became really evident that there was like this new artist toolkit kind of developing. And we really doubled down on some feature stuff that like the remix contest, like stem hosting and remixing, things like that, to kind of help, you know, fill in the gaps of where this online creation and community stuff was going. And it's been really, it was a really, really beneficial decision for us, but yeah, it's been so cool. I mean, also the proliferation of Discord is just fucking crazy. Like,
yeah,
now there's some whole companies running off Discord instead of Slack, which is just like, I think if you explain that to somebody in a gamer chair, like, you know, streaming fucking Fortnite 2 years ago, they'd never believe you, but
yeah,
it's cool to,
it is cool to see, man. I mean, I wonder, you know, where my mind always goes with that is like, well, now that that's happening, like, does that signal the beginning of the end for whatever this phase is? Like, when is Discord going to get acquired by, you know, Microsoft or whoever is going to try to buy it? And where are we going to have to go next?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it'll be Salesforce.
Yeah.
I mean, Microsoft could use the help in terms of the like productivity tools. I mean, I don't know if you've used Microsoft Teams before, but it's absolutely abysmal.
Yeah, luckily I don't have to, but I am very close to people who have to use it daily. And yeah, it's not a hit.
Not a hit at all.
But yeah, man, I mean, let's bounce around a little bit because you were talking about skating and I wanted to go back to that for a second. And you were talking about how that kind of changed the direction of your life. And it's interesting to me, and I'm sure you've had this experience too. How many people in the music industry I talk to, especially the dance music industry, where skateboarding was such a huge factor in I don't know, their worldview, their perspective, their creativity, whatever it is. Like I was talking to Busy P on this podcast a few weeks ago, and I wasn't even expecting it, but like he was talking about his religion, you know, when he was talking about skateboarding. Like, what is that connection? Have you ever thought about like why there's such a strong correlation?
Not necessarily. I haven't really thought about it in reference to dance music so much as music in general, or just like, I don't know. Like I also find the same thing in a lot of creative industries. And I think it's easy to look at, you know, skateboarding in the Olympics and being like, oh, it's a sport. Like, you know, I think a lot of people's association with skateboarding now is a sport, but like, and it was at one point in the 80s and 90s too. It was like this, it was kind of, there's kind of like a real jock mentality around it. But what happened with street skateboarding was like, essentially like, you know, taking this thing that exists, whether it be a set of stairs, you know, or a curb in front of your house or your garage or your like driveway, which was the case for me. And like, without knowing it, like you're just trying to have fun or trying to impress your friends or whatever, but you end up looking at things with a certain creative eye. It's reinterpreting your surroundings in a certain way. And like, I have a really close friend who's married to a very avid skateboarder, and she's a city planner. Her background is in city planning, and he's obviously into skateboarding. And it's those two things sound very disparate, but it's one of their like, you know, great commonalities. But yeah, like I think that like when I was really young, I was really into drawing. My mom is a painter and creative person. She raised me with both my parents are small business owners. She had this graphic design company. So she was really, really creatively oriented, and I was really pushed into that early on. But I think that energy kind of manifested itself in skateboarding more so than anything else. Like I've owned every instrument. I've owned a trumpet, a drum set, a bass, an electric guitar, acoustic guitar, melodica at one point. Like I was trying to learn harmonica.
Nice.
Like anything that I could use to try to make music, like I failed at desperately. And for whatever reason, like, I think my mind was more oriented towards like seeing how I could take like some inanimate civic object and figure out how to have fun with it.
Well, sorry, not to cut you off. I just wanted to say real quick, I like that idea of what you're talking about, the city planner and the skateboarder, because that's almost like making music too, where, you know, somebody can look at a city street and just see the city street, but maybe a skateboarder looks at it and sees, you know, different places they could like execute skateboarding, right? And can you tell I'm not a skateboarder? And
I mean that, and I guess like to bring it back to that, like the only time I really obsessively began making music was after I downloaded Fruity Loops, and I would sample MP3s, and then eventually I finally saved up enough money to buy an ASR10, started flipping vinyl samples, and that's when I hit my stride. That's when I was like ultimately like really, really in the crates, like really becoming obsessed with not only music history, like the genealogy of music and how you know, ideas flow from one genre to the next and how these things influence each other and then how you can make something new out of that. Like I think that obsessive like kind of fascination was definitely with that same part of my mind that was became really into skateboarding very young. So like, yeah, I mean, I think that, and that is very much like a lot of the DNA of dance music too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, talking about sampling in terms of skateboarding and in terms of history is super interesting. I mean, again, coming from somebody who's not much of a skateboarder, does that kind of sampling mentality exist in skateboarding where somebody will try to flip like an old trick and make it new? Yeah.
Especially right now, because I mean, it's a pretty simple machine, right? It's just four wheels and, you know, wheel and axle and a lever. So like there's only so many things that can be done. So just like within fashion, certain things kind of cycle in and out of popularity.
Right.
And fashion is a great example of like aesthetic sampling, you know, taking like, look at Kanye, right? It's not a surprise to me that Kanye, like if you've ever worked with him or spent any amount of time with him, like he's not so much of a creative as he is a aggregator, of fucking awesome ideas and like somebody that reinterprets them. If you listen to his first album, it's all very, very much sample based. His early music is, he's the reason I bought an ASR10 because that was the sampler that he made all of his early beats on.
Right.
And now if you look at what he's doing in fashion, like, or if you're, you know, in any way, like adjacent to his kind of process, and same with Virgil, like Virgil has this, is a very, very big proponent of the 3% rule, which is like, take something that exists and make it 3% different. Like,
yeah,
that's all the school of sampling, essentially.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I talk with people about that all the time because it's so, I think for any artist, and, you know, I guess I'm speaking mainly about music production, but I think for any artist, it's the idea of like, well, how do I find my voice, my signature sound, my signature style? And when you're just starting off, that seems like an impossible idea. But when you break it down to like, no, just like do something slightly different than somebody else, that's a lot more achievable.
And the greatest minds in creativity will tell you, like, I mean, I think you're on one side of the ego fence there. Like I think it's impossible to divorce creative, like anything new from anything that's existed prior. Like you, unless you like literally live in a bubble, or like you're born and raised in a tiny cabin in Montana and never had the internet, especially now, you know, that influence is going to, kind of, how do I want to say, those influences will be pervasively like manifested in whatever you're doing, whether you like it or not. It's just some people refuse to admit it and other people praise it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And that's the difference between, I don't know, people that are honest with themselves and their fans. Like,
yeah.
But I think that it's easy for fans to maybe say like, oh, he's a biter or things like that. But those are typically people that have never tried to create anything. And there's no shame in being influenced by somebody and being reverent of other people's creations.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Kanye is a great example of that because he wears a lot of that on his sleeve. This is a random question, but I feel like you might have a good Kanye story. Did you ever end up near him in some way?
I have a pretty insane Kanye story. It's a long one, but like,
oh, I mean, that's what this show is for, baby.
I think I'm under NDA.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, I mean, everybody that is in his orbit is under NDA, but I will say that, he had somehow come under the, impression that I knew anything about fashion.
Right.
Through Skrillex. Skrillex had told him something. I was mentoring a kid at the time who was 20, who's from North Long Beach. And he's one of the most fantastically talented creative people I've ever met in my life. He's just so like, in terms of like those interpreting those inputs and like putting out something new, he's just so magnificently talented. His name's Dom Glover. He works with Kenny Beats actually a lot now.
Yeah.
I was working with him on a clothing line that like was all him. I was doing nothing except for just like helping try to get it on people. And we had some solid hits, like Bieber was filmed or was, photographed wearing his stuff. And at one point, but anyway, yeah. So I was tasked with getting Kanye, something happened with Ausla. Like we were doing a video premiere at the Ace Hotel downtown. And I was talking to my friend Shay, who was working with Ye at the time. And he was like, yo, I'm going to see you tonight. I'm going to come to the video thing. Like, Ye's going to be there. And I was like, cool. I don't really believe you, but sure. And so I was like, I called Dom and I was like, yo, you should come to this thing and wear all of your own clothing just in case. And Dom sat down next to me and the guy in front of him turned around and it was Kanye. And he was like, I love everything you're wearing. And Dom basically had to remove himself from the situation because he was like, so like overwhelmed.
Oh, wow.
And a couple of days later, we both got the call. Dom drove out. He was summoned to Calabasas to work on the St. Pablo tour merch. And I went to Kanye's house at noon and essentially spent the entire day with him until about 4 p.m. I mean, at 4, I was like, yo, don't you have a flight at 5? And he's like, yeah, I mean, like drive me to the airport. And I was like, okay. do it. And then, so you can walk, I was driving a 2017 Chevy Volt at the time.
Amazing.
We go out to my car, and this is when I was doing a lot of consulting. So I was like literally in my car, like in meetings. I was doing like 4 meetings a day for like, you know, 2 years, and I never really left my car. So like there's just takeout boxes, water bottles. There was water bottles up to the passenger seat. So like you couldn't actually sit in the passenger seat. And he opens up the passenger side door, and they just like dump out onto his driveway in Bel Air, this fucking mansion. And he starts like shoveling them in the back. And the most, dude, like he literally said to me, he like looks at me and he's like, this is the most, he was like, bro, you can't live like this. And I literally told him, I was like, this is the most embarrassing moment of my entire life. And we fucking get in the car and I'm driving to LAX. And he's like, no, you're going to Irvine. And I was like, okay, whatever. And then his assistant calls me and she's like, yo, I need your full name and date of birth. I gave it to her and I'm not having any idea what we're doing or where we're going. Yeah. And we pull into the Irvine airport. There's a jet there. I'm still like asking like, oh, where are we going? And he's like on the phone with whomever, like just like talking to people, like trying to roll out this tour. And we get on the jet. J-Lo's boyfriend was there. I finally find out that we're going to Vegas. we get out, get in the black car, pull up to the back of the MGM Grand. And then we walk into the Conor McGregor fight. And Mike Tyson and Gordon Ramsay were in our seats, so they moved two over.
This is amazing.
And then we watched the fight. I went back to the airport. I was in bed by midnight, and I've never heard from him since. Never heard from anybody on his team since then.
That is it was so the most perfect. Bizarre,
it was the most bizarre 12 hours of my entire life.
That is so.
And I won't share any of the specific details.
That is totally fine. That's an incredible story. I'm just, at what point on the drive did you realize that you were going to get on the jet with him?
I didn't really, I guess, because I've traveled with Skrillex a little bit. I try not to tour. But I've been to these little Vegas excursions a number of times. So it kind of clicked then, but like, it was just bizarre that no one could tell me.
Right.
I have things to do. Like, obviously nothing that was really trumping that, but at the same time, it's kind of like very nerve-wracking. I don't know if we're going to fucking Vegas or Wyoming, for example. Like, that's what the kids now, they get on the jet, that's where they're going.
Yeah, true. Wyoming. True. Yeah, man.
That's kind of his thing, is like keeping young people around that he pulls from. And I wasn't one of those people because I don't consider myself particularly creative, but Dom got to do a lot of work on his line, and that I think that that was a big moment for him. He's now a professional creative director.
Mm. I mean, it's really interesting to me that you say you don't consider yourself that creative, because I feel like almost everything I know about you has been some wildly creative venture in one way or another that you've had your hands in.
I don't think I'm not creative. I just think that like I'm really, really into big problems, and creativity solves problems. But I like art, but like what I really like is systems. Like I really like get excited by the idea of like reorienting, you know, multi-billion-dollar industries towards, you know, towards like equitability and fairness. Not to say that the work I did in my career thus far has really laddered up to that, but like that's my ambition, you know.
So has that always been your ambition? Like, when did you start thinking about it in those terms?
So I was managing this kid Boogie, West Side Boogie, at the time. He's a rapper from Compton.
He's amazing.
He's so talented. And he was signed to Interscope, and I ended up getting in like a lot of like arguments with them, about the way they were treating him or about ways that we disagreed. And I kind of stepped back and was like, yo, like this A&R is not the problem. His boss is not the problem. Like these people are doing what they consider to be good work, and it's work that benefits individuals. But I was like, I was really kind of stepped back because I was like, an hour of my time is helping like two people right now, maybe three people in best case scenario. How do you kind of like step back and scale that? And like how does an hour of my time become, you know, net beneficial for entire communities of people? And how do you help people at scale? And that's kind of when I was like, okay, like it's not like even these labels are basically at odds with other multi-billion dollar companies that are trying to basically centralize all of the power and all of the control within the music industry to these platforms. You could say that as much with Instagram in terms of our attention, which, like, if you think about it as a commodity, is like probably the most abundant commodity in the entire world.
Yeah.
Like Facebook is literally trying to have a monopoly on attention, and Spotify wants a monopoly on ears. And that's evidenced by the fact that, like, their total addressable market is not people who like music. It's people who literally can hear. And that's evidenced by the fact that, like, musicians made Spotify a $42 billion company, probably much higher valuation now.
Yeah.
And then they turn around and they give $100 million to Joe Rogan, who is not a musician.
Yeah.
That's indicative of, like, how much control they want over us, just generally. And so, like, I stepped back from that. Then, like, I kind of had that epiphany in, like, 2017. And I was just really fucking overwhelmed and just like, yo, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, and then somebody asked me to advise their startup that was a ticketing company built on Ethereum. And I was like, what is Ethereum? And then as I dug in more, I was like, holy shit. Like, this is the scratch that you need to start from to be able to really redesign entire, like, systems like that.
Hmm.
Not even like, I don't use the term disrupt. I don't necessarily like the term disrupt. I think disruption is kind of nefarious and often associated with companies that don't give a fuck about people.
Yeah.
But I think that it's a new starting point. Like, a decentralized financial system is a new starting point on which to build decentralized companies that are inevitably more fair and owned by the worker participants. So without getting on a full Marxist tear, like, this is the closest.
Oh, we can go there, baby.
I mean, we don't want to go there because there's always somebody that knows more than I do, apparently.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, systems of disenfranchisement, systems of extracting value from workers, I don't really have any interest in, like, that. Y'all can do that. I think the best defense is a good offense, and that is building alternatives and messaging about those alternatives and telling people about them and describing to just about everybody how just about everybody benefits from these, including major labels. And I am really bullish on the fact that, like, major labels will stand to make, I don't think major labels are bad necessarily. I think that if anybody wanted to explicitly become rich, they would get into finance. Like, I probably should have.
Right.
At some point. You know, like there are way more evil things you can do than work in a major label if you literally are a sociopath with, like, no, you know, regard for human involvement. I do think everybody in the music industry, literally largely at least, everybody in the music industry gets in because they want to help people. They enjoy storytelling. They want to be a part of the iteration of the human experience through music. The problem is that there's not alternatives, functional alternatives, to be able to do so outside of that system. But I think those, you know, large, you know, frameworks of people and institutions, if, you know, given a playing field where everybody's happier, would take that alternative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of one of those, if you build it, they will come situations, I think, because especially for the major labels, I mean, they never want to change. They're not going to do it by, you know, the nature of their goodwill, but...
And they can't, because they're literally, there's no alternative to Spotify.
Sure.
So, like, that's it. You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I do think Spotify is hell for musicians.
Man, that's a banger of a quote right there. I mean, it's funny, man, because it's crazy when you think about, I'm not really saying anything that hasn't been said before, but thinking about the idea of Spotify on not just the way we consume music, but also the way we create music, right? Where all of a sudden, like, the way people wrote songs changed so that it would fit the platform better. That is a scary thought.
It's an extremely scary thought. I mean, I think if you look back on it, like, it's really acutely evident too. Like, I don't think we get an NWA in 2021.
Yeah.
And not to say that the former, you know, permutations of the music industry were necessarily not disadvantageous to musicians, but, like, at least there was, like, people willing to try something because there were multiple avenues through which you could reach audiences, you know, you look at Fat Records or, you know, Loud Records and stuff. These companies that had, like, you know, they're not designed for everybody to like them.
Yeah.
That's the point. But those people that do like them will pay every time for the CD with that logo on it, whether they heard it or not. Because there's a cultural capital around that. There's a sense of community. There's an alignment of ideas and ideals and things like that associated with those brands and those collectives of creatives. We don't have that anymore. And I think that's one of the big great tragedies is that labels literally don't fucking matter in terms of a brand capacity. They just have to go for market share because it's the only way they're going to make money. But like there was a very like Fat Mike from NoFX, the owner of Fat Records, is a very rich man. He's not a billionaire, but like he's not wanting for anything. You know what I'm saying? Like, and that's if you take that as like a microcosm of what's happening economically across, you know, the US economy, it's like, there doesn't need to be billionaires. Like it literally does not help anybody. And frankly, I don't think there needs to be Drake or Taylor Swift either. Like I think I'd rather have 10,000 Drakes or 10,000 West Side Boogies than one Drake. Because in many countries, the government subsidizes creatives because they understand that it's a quality of life. It benefits the masses to have art in their lives. So it's subsidized. It shouldn't necessarily be subsidized, but it is. But that's even a better situation than we have in America, where like being a musician is like a professional musician is not only a huge luxury, it's a fucking grind.
And oh,
it's a
man.
It's not like that much fun.
I still remember the first time I learned that Canadian radio, mandated by federal law, had to play a certain amount of Canadian artists per day. Like hearing that, that like just rearranged my brain because it was so foreign to me as an American musician to think that there would be any kind of support from larger systems for that.
It's insane. And so now, like, what is the alternative? Well, if you want to be on the Spotify playlist, you have to make Spotify music. And that's really scary because like, you know, music and many people will, many people argue that music predates the written language. You know what I'm saying? Like this is, in many cases, the most primal way that humans communicate and express ideas. And many of those ideas are dissent. And if we don't have that, like we're losing major, major footing in terms of like humanity's capacity to change shit for the better. And like that's really fucking scary. And I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with the TikTok to Spotify pipeline. Like, I think that's great. And it works really well for a lot of people, like keep that going, but it doesn't work for a vast majority of people. And those people are largely uncompensated for their 10,000 hours.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, man. And it's, I think this is a good way. I'm going to keep bouncing around a little bit here. I think this is a good way to talk about how you first sort of were introed to Audius and how that relationship started. But before we get there, just because I feel like, again, this is maybe a good story, talking about NWA and how they maybe couldn't exist in 2021 Spotify if they were a new act. I saw it, this is very random, but I saw that you once tweeted that you interviewed Chuck D at an Apple store.
Yeah.
And I feel like this story needs to be told at this time.
So yeah, like... I mean, that goes back to skateboarding. Like I left Boise. I didn't go to college. I barely graduated high school. And Boise is in this like, this little pocket of cities, where like it for the most part, it's super idyllic. And because of that, I don't know, like small city problems are very different than large city problems. Large city problems also have the small city problems, but they're not without their problems. And in Idaho, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, all across the Midwest to, Ohio specifically, this was like the height of the opioid epidemic. And a lot of my friends, my first friend died of an overdose when I was 14.
Oh, God.
And a lot of people were getting really, really into drugs. A lot of people were getting pregnant. And my parents were just kind of like, yo, like you don't have to go to college, but you can't live here. And I highly suggest you don't live in Boise.
Wow.
San Francisco is like the hub of skateboarding, like street skateboarding. And so I just started applying to any label, like all these indie labels in like, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, cities that I'd never actually been to San Francisco. The only reply I got back was from Quantum Records, who put out a lot of my favorite rap CD, like indie rap CDs then. Blackalicious label, DJ Shadow, things like that.
Yeah, they were putting out a ton of amazing music. I was a big backpacker back in the day too.
Yeah, huge backpacker. And And then, so I went down to interview for the internship, and I was like, hey, like, just so you know, I moved here for this internship, so you have to give it to me.
How'd that go over?
And so, like, I was staying in a hostel. I got a job across the street at the Starbucks, cleaned up a lot of needles, and got that internship going. And then, eventually, like, just started meeting people through skateboarding, and, got this job at a music tech startup. Where I it was early in the like music discovery algo days. I listened to rap 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, for 2 years, like manually tagging rap songs, like, misogynistic lyrics at high presence, cymbals, shakers, 98 BPMs, like tagging regionalities. So I'm like going through like the Dayton Family catalog, who no one probably knows about, but like they're an obscure, like Midwestern, like horrorcore group. And just like, I got fucking encyclopedic like pretty quickly. Wow. And one of the guys that worked there, that I skated with, knew people at Thrasher, and, I mentioned I fucking did really poorly in high school, but I did really, really well in English. Mm-hmm. My dad was a writer, and I always had books around. I was reading like Stephen King when I was in like second grade and stuff.
Oh, great.
Yeah, look how that turned out.
Great books to read when you're in second grade.
Yeah. So somebody at Thrasher was like, hey, like, we're getting a lot of rap promos. Like, I know that you're into music. Do you want to like do some interviews? And I started doing them, and yeah, I interviewed a bunch of awesome people. And Chuck D from Public Enemy was one of them, but he didn't want to leave that Apple store. So we just did the interview there.
That's so funny.
I interviewed, I'm trying to remember, like it was a lot of them. I mean, I still have some of the issues laying around, but yeah, it was my first bylines. I interviewed like Aesop Rock, and anyway, so like I was getting those press releases forwarded to me from Thrasher, and eventually he was just like, let me put you in touch with the publicist so you can just field these by yourself. And then that's how I came in touch with Catherine Fraser and Dana Meyerson at Biz3. And I started covering a bunch of their artists for Thrasher. And then, yeah, I mean, then I ended up through some crazy shit, moving to Catherine's basement.
I want to talk about that in a little detail, just because I was in Chicago at the same time. And that's when I became aware of you, which I don't know. I don't think I've ever talked to you about this, but we have a mutual friend, Nicole, who, when you were moving to town, she like specifically approached me and was like, my friend Clayton is moving to Chicago. He doesn't know a lot of people here. Like, can you guys be friends? Like, will you, you know, show him around or whatever? And I said I would, and then I didn't. And I was just, I don't know. I was like, I don't know what was going on with me at the time, but like, I just never really made that connection with you then, and later regretted it. Cause I was like, oh man, like we got all the same friends and we're involved in similar shit. Like that would have been a good time.
Yeah, I was so inundated with work back then. Like, so like Catherine hired me, like I definitely lied on my resume and told her that I was a publicist. Yeah. It was just kind of like a half lie. Like I managed a band in San Francisco that was actually like this, that was like the pet project of this VC, of like this guy who was a super like big tech dude, but he had a tech PR company. And so I managed his band in office hours from his PR office, but they did mobile tech PR. It's like not anything like any music PR.
Right.
But I used him as a reference and was like, yeah, see, I was a publicist. And she was like, okay. And then I got there and she was like, you don't know anything. Like you're absolutely useless to me. And I said, yeah, but I live in your basement now.
Yeah.
I did the same move. I just like inserted myself irrevocably.
Tenants' rights. You can't evict me.
And she literally tried to fire me. She tried to fire me a lot.
I to this day, and I, you know, I don't know her super well at all. Obviously, I know you guys are very close, but anytime I've ever been around her, like she just has such a strong presence that like, even though she's a sweetheart, like I'm intimidated every time.
Definitely. And back then, I mean, she does transcendental meditation and like life coaching now. And she's very successful at that as well. But back then, she was she was obviously a very sweet woman, but like her management style at the time was a little bit more brusque than it is now. I have a call with her tomorrow, by the way.
Nice. and for people who don't know, I guess we should give context too. So we're talking about Biz3, which is a legendary PR company based out of Chicago. And I mean, back in that day, it's crazy to think back, like how many big artists they were handling all running out of Catherine's apartment, right? Like, again, very small team. You were talking about how Audius is a small team. Like, Biz 3 was what? Like, just a few people handling, like, global shit for giant artists.
Yeah, it was like five of us in a living room rolling out the Daft Punk album. Yeah. it was pretty insane. But yeah, and so, like, when I moved in, like, I had never been to Chicago. I didn't know anybody. Nicole was introduced me through a mutual friend from San Francisco. And yeah, she... Thank God for her. I actually thought about this the other day because I was hanging out with a friend that I met in Chicago through Nicole.
Yeah.
But like, honestly, thank God, because like, I didn't know anybody and she just opened up the address book for me. It was great.
So talk about Chicago for a minute, like in that period of your life, because I think let's split it into two things. Like, I want to know where you were at in life at that time. And then I also want to know, just in terms of publicity and PR, I think people don't really understand what that is or how that works or why artists need it. And you know, especially something like Biz 3, which has been so influential as far as, you know, just giant artists now.
Well, I can tag that back to the industry stuff. Like in my personal life, I was an absolute mess, I had just lost my dad. I had gone through a breakup. I was pretty lost, but like I knew that I wanted to work in the music industry. Catherine changed my life. Like she gave me the first opportunity, even though like it was suboptimal for her at the time. And ultimately she introduced me to Skrillex, who I co-founded a record label with. And you know, like that was just, if that hadn't happened, I don't know where it'd be. But, but in terms of like publicity, what I learned was I was really good at it actually. Eventually, there are processes around these kinds of things that like, you know, you don't necessarily understand, but like the core for me of being a publicist and a marketer is from storytelling and from writing. So I was a voracious reader, and like marketing is just storytelling. And I do consider PR a function of a marketing function. It's just storytelling. You have to tell the story of why this matters. And like, again, the human experience is what makes music great. And I was really good at that because I understood stories, and I still think I do. I'm also extremely disorganized person. That's a big part of sending sending 15,000 emails a day and then fielding the replies is like very difficult. I also think the nature of publicity has probably changed. I don't have skin in the game anymore, but like, I think it's become through social media, a lot more personal for a lot of things. It's less like spray and pray, I would assume. And a lot more based on personal relationships and saying no a lot, I think is probably really important these days because there's just so much. I mean, 40,000 songs hit Spotify every day. So like, I think that what Biz3 has done to really separate themselves and define themselves in the marketplace is like, they're just very premium now. Like, you know, Catherine does The Weeknd. They've kind of, you know, carved out this niche for themselves where it's like, if you are at that level, there's one person you talk to, which is really cool. That was the thing, is that like, you used to be able to get this, put a song on SoundCloud, whether it be a remix or whatever else, and you'd have access to this huge like user base and this, like people would be getting ticket, like soft ticket shows, like offers overnight, festival offers and stuff like that. And because blogs were there to support it, to add the context to the music, and you could embed the song in a story about, how all this happened. I think that was like such a magical time for the music industry. Like the SoundCloud era was so, that was when you were, making a lot of music too. And like Chicago had this whole little scene of people that were uploading music to SoundCloud, you, Floss, like all these other people. And like those would be seemingly disparate if you didn't have people like Catherine being like, no, this is a thing that's happening right now. And like this little scene is making music that's reaching the globe. And like what was happening with Philly, with The Rub, or like, the early Mad Decent stuff, or what happened with Fool's Gold in Brooklyn, like these micro scenes were having global impact. And it's like taking that out of, a geographical location where everybody knows each other and espousing it to the world changed the way that people listen to music, which changed the way people make music and changed the way people think about their own lives and their capacity to have a creative career. That is one of the great tragedies of the streaming era now, is there is no context. Like there's no way of knowing like what's the difference between Olivia Rodrigo and somebody who made a better song than her or, or made a worse song and has a crazy story that they're telling from a personal place. I think she's a phenomenal storyteller. She's probably a bad example. But like, how would we know? You know,
right? So, yeah, I mean, it makes me think about something you said earlier again, which is finding community, right? Like, Spotify is not a community, whereas SoundCloud was a community at a certain point.
Exactly. And that's absolutely our mission with Audius too.
So you just beat me to the punch, but I wanted to make that connection because when Audius first came out and when I first started learning about it, and especially once you got on board, because I knew you, I was following what you were saying about it. It was the first time where I really felt like, well, the way this is being talked about and the way this sounds reminds me of how SoundCloud used to feel when I was coming up. Like, is that a conversation you've had internally? Is that absolutely something you guys think about?
Oh yeah. I mean, we literally just wanted to make SoundCloud, but good.
Yeah.
and I think we're on the way to do that. But yeah, like those micro communities, like I get so excited. Like there's Discord helps a lot. Obviously like new features will help, like commenting, groups, things like that. You know, no timeline on any of that, but like, ultimately, if the community wants to build it, that's the other thing about Audius, is that there's this community of listeners, there's a community of creators, and there's also a community of developers that get to build on top of this protocol and build the things that they want to see and own it and govern it. And that's where we become, you know, supercharged SoundCloud, where it's like this thing that's like we all own and we all have skin in the game. But yeah, like the things that excite me the most about Audius on a day-to-day are like finding like this Brazilian psytrance community that has like 20 artists that are just making music that I don't fucking listen to, but like, they love it. And like, they're reaching people on the other side of the world. And then like, all of a sudden, I don't know, is Brazil going to be the psytrance capital of the world soon? Maybe. Can we be a part of that? I hope so. Like, it's cool to see.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Japan, like what's happening with Japan in terms of consumption patterns and music, really crazy. Cause like, they didn't really latch on to Spotify or to SoundCloud. Like, they still sell a lot of vinyl and a lot of CDs in Japan. And outside of that, you know, Gen Z and the younger generation now is using, I think they use Spotify in Japan, but like whatever, you know, DSP, is just jamming content down their faces.
Yeah.
And they never really had that SoundCloud era. So Japan at one point in last year was, our second biggest streaming market, our second biggest user base.
Interesting.
Now we're seeing Latin America come on because like in many cases, like I think what's going to happen with Spotify is pretty interesting, but like on global scale, if they want to get every ear on earth, like the unit economics don't really work out for places that are still developing, like India, Mexico, for example. Mexico City is the fastest growing music streaming market in the world. And like many of those people, like the subscription is kind of untenable. And like also like reaching American audiences is very difficult. So these insular communities exist, and we just want to be like this connective tissue between them and hopefully among themselves too. Like, just the ability to share music, share stems, have your homie down the street remix it and upload and tag it to Audius. Like, that is such an awesome feeling to watch that happen. And we're just trying to see it. It's cool.
It's so cool, man. And, you know, we've been dancing around this a lot, I think, but to make it explicit, because a lot of producers and up and coming artists do listen to this podcast, like for somebody who doesn't exactly know what Audius is or why they should get involved with it as a creative, like what's the quick elevator pitch for it?
The elevator pitch is SoundCloud when it was cool and good instead of bad and lame. But it's a music streaming platform that is owned and operated by the people that make Tidal, which are the artists. Audius is built on the Ethereum blockchain, but 90% of our users don't even know that. It's just a place to upload music and share it. Higher quality audio than SoundCloud, 320 kilobits per second. Always free to upload, unlimited uploads, 2 hours of streaming time. It is geared towards the people that listen to this, and very much towards independent musicians largely. There are a lot of big people on the platform. Deadmau5, obviously, Skrillex, Russ, Made in Tokyo, like really, really big artists across the spectrum that are really into this. And it doesn't necessarily look, we don't really think of ourselves, to be really explicit again, as a competitor to Spotify. Like, do what you're doing on Spotify. But there's tons of things that you're not going to want to plop, like just jamming up your profile, like Works in Progress, flips, things like that. Like all these kinds of fun things that like make creating music fun. And it's also a lot of the times the entry point for artists,
you
know, like the way that people are exposed to learning about how to make music. A lot of people are using it as like a scratch pad and a way to build a community around these ideas.
Oh, that's great.
And yeah, and I think that we're going to cross 5 million monthly active users tomorrow or today, which will make us, by many measures, the fastest growing music streaming platform in the world right now.
Ooh.
Which is cool. And there is lots going on. So anybody that listens to this, just check it out, audius.co.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's crazy, man, doing this podcast, talking to so many people over the last few years, like, a question I ask a lot, we talk a lot about the golden era of SoundCloud, and that's how so many artists that we know came up. And one question I ask a lot of people, and I get the same answer every time, is, you know, if you came up now, do you think you could have done it in the same way? Do you think you'd, you know, be in the same position? And almost everybody says there's no way, because with the climate the way it is.
Yeah, I agree that there's just no access point. Again, 40,000 songs a day. Like, how do you cut through that? Maybe you cut through it with by being active in the audience Discord. Maybe you trade reposts, which is the activity that we totally, you know, encourage. Build these little micro communities and grow them out, and then rise on top of it. And we've seen artists, like, it's cool. I mean, we've only been around for 20 months now, maybe 21. But there's people that, like, started on audience that, like, in our first 10,000 users, that, you know, we're making great music that wasn't getting heard on SoundCloud or on Spotify and stuff like that. And now they're getting label releases. Like, they're putting out amazing music that's actually getting listened to on other platforms because they have these communities around them, right? Finally, that they built on this. And, you know, this woman, Tsunami.
She's incredible. She was just on this show.
Awesome. She's such a phenomenal producer. And she was one of our earliest users and proponents, just throwing up all kinds of music. And now, and, you know, I think she was playing locally then, but, like, her career is really, really, like, taken off. And I'm in no way taking credit for that, but I would like to think that her experience and audience at least helped her build relationships that, like, you know, have helped kind of continue to grow that career. And I want to see that, you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of times.
Yeah. I mean, it's so cool, man. I think the difference, when I'm hearing you talk about this, I mean, it's a philosophical difference at the end of the day, right? Where you're saying, yeah, do what you're doing on Spotify. Like, they're not our competitor. This is not what that's about. Right.
Yeah exactly. I mean, and to be, so, like, I was mentioning, this is a two-part answer. Like, that's the easy answer, is, like, Spotify, like, audience is a music streaming community. The other answer that's a little bit more technical and a little bit more interesting to me is that Audius has the capacity to be a totally new music industry, because the fact that we're decentralized and everybody has skin in the game and everybody is remunerated for healthy network behavior means that you can be a professional curator on Audius at some point. Hopefully, like, right now, there's people earning 100 audio a week for curating great playlists. That's never existed. And audio, let's think about audio as representative of ownership of this platform. Audio is the token. It's an ERC-20 token built on the Ethereum blockchain. You're earning stake in this platform by making it better. Like,
by participating, that has never,
that has never existed on any other platform. I mean, SoundCloud, like, I don't care how many fucking playlists you curate or how many repos you do or how many songs you upload, you're never getting stock in a company. And so people like you and people like me and people like all of our friends made SoundCloud an $800 million company. They turn around and sell it to the guys that own fucking Sirius and Pandora.
Right.
It's like, we can't even use it for the purpose for which it was designed. And now you're kicking us off and we got no long-term upside. Like, that's fundamentally fucked up. There haven't been alternatives, really. I mean, this technology has only really hit its stride in the last 4 years. That's what I was saying. When I found Ethereum, I was like, holy shit, this is going to be the thing. It's probably going to be the music first, because music's always a canary in the coal mine. Like, you know, without early days of peer-to-peer, we wouldn't have Napster, or we wouldn't have YouTube. Wouldn't have Netflix.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, just finding stuff like this, you know, whether it's Ethereum or whether it's, you know, these ideas of these alternate philosophies for these platforms, like, does it make you look back at anything you've done in your career differently? Like, let's go back to Ausla, because we haven't talked about that. You know, you're one of the co-founders of Ausla. Does Ethereum not existing, Audius not existing in those, like, what would be different if that had existed when you were founding Ausla?
I can't even begin to think about it. I mean, I don't really feel even comfortable speculating, because, like, I don't think that, like, whether it's systemically or individually, like, I think we have to fucking make those mistakes to be able to recalibrate and say, like, explore those alternatives.
So, I mean, I'm with you there. Yeah.
If anything, if this had existed then, it probably wouldn't, like, if this technology had existed then, yeah, obviously I'd be a huge proponent of it. But at the same time, like, I think that things had to hit a tipping point to get to the place where like people are like, okay, this whole shit is fucked up. Like Facebook basically throwing the fucking election for us. Like these are systems that are not designed for our benefit. And I think that's glaringly apparent to a vast amount of people. So I don't think it would have been beneficial because we had to get to the point where artists are like, listen, I am so fucking sick of this. And same with the pandemic. It's like, cool. Like a lot of this stuff came to light because like the only revenue source for a lot of musicians just evaporated overnight. Like I will in no way say the pandemic was beneficial to anybody, but I do think it was a tipping point at which people were like, okay. This doesn't make sense. Like there's gotta be something else. I'm a chronic optimist for the most part. Like I try to look at things as like a, you know, Nalgene half full person. but it's been really fucking difficult since 2016. And I think that if there is a silver lining there, it's just that people are fucking fed up. There's very few things that give me hope, honestly, but decentralized networks is among them. Yeah.
Mm. It's so interesting, man, because to hear you talk about this, like, I do look at you as a voice of authority in stuff like this. I don't know if you feel that way, but that is how I look at you.
I mostly interact with people who graduated from Stanford, so I definitely don't. Thank you.
But that's probably good. You probably shouldn't. I think it's better that I think that way. It's just interesting to think about where this all starts, right? Like you were saying, you started working in publicity when you didn't really know how to do it, and you just kind of showed up and were thrown into the fire with it. And again, we've been talking about all this record label, major label infrastructure, you're experiencing managing artists that were on these labels. But when you founded Ousla with Skrillex and others, I have to assume you didn't have a ton of label experience either.
No, none. Yeah. So, and I want to be also really clear, like this is a very important point that I want to make. I completely acknowledge that a lot of this like is a function of privilege, like 100%, like a function of specifically white male privilege. Like there is, like, I do not subscribe to this idea, this fucking Gary Vaynerism, and they're like, oh, I did it, you could do it too. Like, not that I don't think anybody can do it, but what I have witnessed in my career is that like the greatest privilege is having parents that tell you that you can do anything and you believe in it. And that has been something that I don't take for granted at all.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think it's that common, especially when like, you know, the certain conversations are dominating, the minds of other people. And a lot of those conversations are like, okay, don't get killed by the police. If you see the police, just put your hands in the air and act like a certain way.
Right.
And that, you know, there are other people in this world don't have the opportunity that I have had. And frankly, like the confidence that I have, the confidence or stupidity that I, my appetite for risk, I'll say that much, is not it. It's something that I'm happy about, and that I has defined my career and my life in general, whether that be physically skateboarding and jumping off shit in the water, which I love to do, or like taking these career risks. Like that is the greatest privilege, and that is why I don't feel comfortable solving small problems, because I have the luxury of being able to know that if this shit doesn't work out, I'll still be able to figure something out.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's fair to assume everybody else has that same luxury.
Yeah. 100%.
But I love rolling the dice. Like, and this is a huge dice roll. Like this is, you know, crypto is in fucking pets.com era right now.
pets.com. Like, that's great.
Like, this is like, you know, but it was the only thing that I felt really where like I felt like I could be well deployed and still get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I want to go back to just a little bit when you were working with Catherine and you meet Skrillex, and how did it happen? Was it that Sonny asked you to build the label with him?
I was working with Catherine, and the story is, it depends on who you hear from.
Yeah.
But I'll tell my interpretation of it, which I believe to be the true one. I was working, I was DJing in San Francisco. That's when kind of like the Blog House thing was starting to hear this halftime stuff. And I wasn't really familiar with dubstep at the time, but like I was hearing remixes that sounded more like rap that you can mix with like a TI song because it was 70 BPM, 65 BPMs. I was like, okay, cool. I know this shit. And eventually, like when I was in, I did, without knowing what it was called, it became some of my favorite stuff to play out at least. And then when I was in Chicago, Catherine was like, hey, like, does anybody, like she stood up in the office, was like, does anybody here know who, what dubstep is? And I was like, yeah, totally. I totally know exactly what dubstep is. I'm kind of like,
yeah, there's that rolling the dice again.
Yeah. And she was like, okay, cool. This guy Skrillex is going to play this show downtown. Atlantic is super hot on him because apparently like his numbers, his touring was crazy. Like he was doing like 5,000 tickets at that time and no one knew who this kid was.
Yeah. This
like,
is very, very early like, Skrillex.
Yeah. And it was like scene kids that knew who he was from the days of like, from first to last kids that were like, you know, really, really on the internet and really plugged in. But like the general populace didn't know who it was, but Kalman at Atlantic knew that as anybody does when you meet him, like this kid's an absolute fucking superstar. Like there's, when you meet Sonny, there's just no doubt like yeah. what was going to happen at that point. And so I met him and we clicked really well. And then, I was like, I was his day-to-day publicist for a long time. Catherine obviously, you know, did the heavy lifting, like, you know, called Rolling Stone, called Spin, got him all of his covers and stuff like that. But I was the one that was like in the trenches, scheduling a lot of stuff, doing all the blogs, online stuff. I just, the thing that really was it for me that was like, I started interacting with his manager, Tim Smith, who's I talked to this morning, who's a mentor and a very close friend, who I love dearly. Tim is just very different than other people in the music industry. Like managers at a certain level in the music industry, become as a forced function, like they become, sort of, I don't want to say arrogant, but like you have to beat people up basically for a living. Yeah. Like you basically have to be like the bad guy.
They're the bad guy full time.
Yeah. And Tim was operating at this level where I was like, why is he so nice to me? And publicists are at the bottom of the fucking food chain in reference to the music industry in many cases.
Yeah.
Or they're treated as such and they shouldn't be. I was just used to getting like basically fucking flicked off. Like, you know, just like,
yeah,
leave me alone. Like, it's just a blog. Like, leave us alone. But Tim was always like super, super fucking cool and like really communicative, really empathetic, and just awesome. And I was like, basically at that time, I was like, anything that you are doing, I want to do. So let me know if I can do more. And I'm also working like 10 hour days at this time. Like I didn't have bandwidth, but I was like, I'll find the fucking time. I don't, this is probably why you and I didn't hang out more.
Yeah.
Because I literally was working like 14 hour days by the end of this. We just became close. And one day he was just like, hey, do you we're thinking about starting a label. It'll be light at first, you know, we're just putting out a couple of releases a year, but we'd love to have you involved. We think you're great. And I was like, yeah, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that without Catherine involved because like she is essentially had saved my life at that point. Mm. And so I asked Catherine, I was like, yo, Tim and Sonny want to do this label. We should do it together. She thinks she will attest to the opposite.
Right.
this is what I believe to be true. We kicked it off. We hired our first guy, like fucking maybe 7 months in, put out Porter Robinson's first album, put out Zed's first single, put out Kill the Noise's first record.
Yeah. By the way, Jake is, I think, listening to this right now. So hi, Jake.
What's up, Jake? Well, yeah, and it just kind of took off from there. And then in 2013, we decided to kind of supercharge it. And I moved to LA and also ran his publishing company for a while and signed a bunch of people there.
And you were doing, I mean, you took on a few different roles in Ausla, like during your time there, right? Like, am I right that you were doing A&R at some point?
Yeah. I mean, I it was kind of like everybody doing everything. I was definitely like doing most of the PR for like the day-to-day stuff. And then I was A&Ring a bunch of stuff, just generally babysitting people. The team got pretty big at one point. I think we were like, you know, 12 people or something. For an indie label, it was pretty good. It was also like, there is in many cases, like things that we would want to do that we didn't have the agency to do because we aren't Skrillex. Right. And as a result, that's why everything feels so uniquely curated that came out on that label. Because like at the end of the day, you know, there's one person driving, like steering this ship. We're all co-founders and, you know, we all have skin in the game and want to see the best, like, you know, want to ensure that everybody is, you know, like taken care of. But at the end of the day, the goal for Ausla was never to make money.
Right.
And I'm really proud of that. Mm-hmm. I think very few founders would say that they're proud of the fact that their first startup never made money. But that was how it was designed to be. It was not designed to be a commercial vehicle. It was designed to be a support system for artists that Sunny thought deserved to be on a stage that was larger than the one they were on. And that experience in terms of A&R informed absolutely like what we're doing in terms of Audius and in terms of things like that. Like we would, you know, SoundCloud was where we found everything, is where Sunny found everything through different avenues. It's how we, you know, facilitate a lot of collaboration. And again, like I think even labels that would want to put out, you know, the same volume of music that we did would be hard pressed to find good stuff in many cases. Like digging through the demo inbox is not the move.
Yeah.
You know, the SoundCloud would surface things that were high quality and then you find them and you're like, hey, like, let's put something out. It still happens, but it's not like it was.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you're the Ausla track record. I mean, you listed a bunch, you know, Porter and Zed and all that. I mean, it's crazy, not only in terms of just how many of these artists are still super influential artists that we talk about to this day, but also, I mean, just culturally at the time in the dance scene, you know, which is always my lens, like it shook up the whole landscape, you know, like yeah. It really felt different than what other labels, even like there were a lot of cool labels, but what you guys were doing felt different. It felt like you had different ideas about it or different goals.
That was definitely came from Sunny. Yeah. And frankly, I have heard that a lot and I'm obviously extremely complimented by it. Nothing makes me happier. Definitely didn't realize it at the time. Like we were just having fun. And also like I didn't come from another label and was like, yeah, let's do something different. I was like, let's do anything. Right. Like, let's do what you want to do. And hopefully it works. And it did, but like, I've heard that from a lot of people. They're like, yeah, like it's hard when you're in the woods like that.
Yeah.
Like it's hard to see the trees, I guess is the best way to put it. And it's also like, dude, there's pictures of people like, cutting themselves like Skrillex logos into their arms and shit. Dude, we used to get fan mail with like this kid. I don't know who it was. I hope he's not listening, but this kid would draw pentagrams in blood and send them to the Biz 3 office with Sonny's name on it. Like there was crazy wow. fans. Like his fans were like so huge. Like his fans were like lifers, you know?
Yeah.
And like for me, I never listened to emo. I listened to rap almost exclusively for most of my life. So like, like I was like, oh, these kids really seem to like this guy. Like, but it was just like, that's my friend Sonny. Like I met him when he was, you know, on an upward trajectory, but not at, like at the level he is now.
Yeah.
And so like, it was easy for me to just kind of be like, oh yeah, that's Sonny. Like, what? But like, yeah, I mean.
Well, and he's like that as a person too, you know?
I mean, it also helps that he's like the most like low key, like super, super like humble and sweet guy.
Like yeah, like down so to earth doesn't even really cut it.
Yeah, one could be pardoned for mistaking him for not a global superstar if they didn't see him, I guess.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Like
he doesn't bring it. So yeah, I thank you. I mean, it's a huge compliment, but like it is never something that ever really occurred to me until really honestly, like Audius has kind of help me zoom out a lot and like look at that and have people like the founders being like who are huge Skrillex fans like right. And like or like you know people on the staff being like he uploaded something to Audius and I think one of the Slack messages is like, dude, Harish, Skrillex just uploaded something to your UI, and I'm like, or like I think Harish is on the protocol side, but forgive me, Harish. But yeah, like it's like they're like, it's a big fucking deal to our team when he started fucking with us because like they built it because of him in many cases, like people like him. And that was kind of like a huge reckoning. Like that was cool to see. And yeah. It always feels cool. I think working with Sunny really made it made everything kind of feel flat. If that makes sense in terms of like,
yeah.
There wasn't ever really like any sort of hierarchy for me. And I think that also was demonstrated in the way that like he treats artists too. Like, he'll find a kid from fucking the middle of fucking nowhere, fly them to LA, put him up in his fucking mansion and like, or it's not a mansion. It used to be called Molino. And they would stay there and make music for fucking months. Like that happened all the time. I mean, Chance the Rapper like spent a lot of time in that house. Like I picked up Chance on one of his first LA trips when I was trying to I sent Acid Rap to Sonny, also Acid Rap, an album that can never exist without SoundCloud.
Ooh, there you go.
I sent Acid Rap to Sonny and he was just like, dude, this kid's fucking unreal. Like we got to work with him. And I'm like, we're a dance label, but fuck
sure.
it. Like, let's find out.
Yeah.
I mean, and then Chance was just in the mix for like months and months. And like, again, like he kind of got insanely famous during that period of time. And it never really occurred to me until much later, you know?
Right.
I think that we're all just conditioned to get used to the idea of people in the music industry dunking and just being dicks. And frankly, it probably happens now more than it did even then, because the playing field was so much more level. Like you could have a song on SoundCloud exploding and all of a sudden you're playing the same two festivals as the people that inspired you.
Yeah.
And it happened overnight.
Yeah. I mean, do you look back at that time? Obviously, you know, I'm sure you still have a relationship with Sonny, but in those early years, like, was there anything working closely with him that you took away from that? Did it change the way you worked? Did it change the way you looked at this business?
I wouldn't say it changed it, because I didn't really look at the business before that.
Right.
It definitely informed everything for sure. Just in terms, like mostly the way you treat people. That's as much of a Catherine Frazier and Tim Smith thing as it is anything else. The two people I consider my greatest mentors. They're just not like, just don't be shitty.
Right.
And if you know it's shitty, then don't do it. and I would probably be a lot more successful in the music industry if I hadn't embraced that mentality like early on.
Yeah.
Like shitty people go really far in the music
it's
industry.
It's crazy.
Like, really
yeah.
and not even like actively evil people, just people who like either knowingly or unknowingly participate in behavior that is net detrimental to creators. Like if I didn't have that like hanging over my head, like bro, I'd be you know, I'd be running a major label right now if I wanted to. That's maybe not necessarily the case, but I could probably be, you know, some sort of SVP or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of all of that, how did it come that you ended up like leaving Ausla or sort of stepping back a little bit?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. So like the fact is the company was not designed to make money. And I didn't really see a future where I would be able to do the things that I wanted to do in terms of my life, like own property.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, only something that's been recently possible even. It just felt like I could be, first of all, I have like an insatiable need to be learning and to be taking risks and things like that. And it just felt like it was in a place where like, it's doing what it's doing. Like, it's doing what we said that we wanted it to do. And that was, you know, I mean, I would say that if Western capitalism has any benefit, is that it does encourage competition and hence innovation. With that component removed, like Ausla didn't need to do anything that it wasn't already doing. I didn't need to grow beyond where it was. And I wasn't necessarily feeling like I was learning anything. You know, it kind of like solved that puzzle. Or we collectively solved that puzzle. You know, I just had a discussion with Sonny and I was like, I think I want to like focus on management and doing other things like just, you know, film, TV, whatever. And he was super supportive and he bought me out.
Yeah. That's huge, man. And what was it like, why were you thinking about management at that time? You know, obviously you said you were managing the band in San Francisco way back, but
I felt like, I think that Pat, the manager, had a big influence on me. Pat was Chance's manager. We're very good friends. And he's a brilliant, brilliant dude. And I think that I looked at that as the relationship that he had with not only the creative, the talent, but like with the actual art, like, I wanted to have more of a creative fingerprint on the trajectory of an artist, and now I don't at all.
Right.
In fact, I still manage a phenomenally talented kid who's doing really, really well. He signed to Atlantic, named Matt Mason, and I am absolutely completely removed from the creative process. Like it has nothing to do with me, and I'm really proud of that. I helped facilitate him having a, you know, long career.
Right.
But at the time, I think that there was like a creative itch that I wanted to scratch that I wasn't with Ausla. And yeah, I mean, and also like I wanted to work in rap. Like I always had like some of my earliest memories of music were like rap. Like I subscribed to two magazines when I was growing up and they were The Source and Thrasher. Like I really wanted to work in rap and I had met Boogie. And I still, to this day, think he's just so immensely talented and has such a high ceiling and is continuing to grow.
He's amazing. I remember I knew about him because of you, because you were managing him and posting about him and all that. And then, you know, once he dropped the song, Oh My, I think is when a lot more people started finding out about him. And that song, too. I mean, I feel like, you know, you were talking about being more involved creatively. I could sort of feel your hands in the rollout of that song as well.
That was, and that was like one of my proudest moments of my career was when we dropped that. And I think that he's probably, I don't think he'll hear this, but if he did, he'd probably hate me for me to say this because I don't think he likes that song anymore. Yeah. Most artists don't like their first big song. You know, I would say like 99% of them hate it, their first breakout song. But yeah, for me, that was something that I wanted to do for a long time. And we took it to the Hot 100. Like, and you know, when I met him, he had half of the song done and he was rapping about like getting passed over by girls because he had a lisp. And then he just became this fucking monster. Like he like literally, when we got the Oh My beat, his kid, I think his kid was like 3 at the time, maybe 4 or something like that. I don't know. But he played the beat for his, because he was just writing in his bedroom, you know?
Yeah.
He played the beat for his kid and his kid started dancing. And that's actually like, a lot of people will tell you that's how you know. Like when a kid, like when you play demos for kids, they have this absolutely like virgin affiliation with it. Like they listen to it for how it sounds.
Yeah.
There is no context. And if you get a kid into a song, like that's like, it's not a jaded person, you know, like the purity of that music will be resonant with them in a way that it's not with anybody else. And his kid fucking loved that song. And so we knew we had something.
Jaleel Beats who made it, right? The beat?
No, coming off, like, I don't know how we got that fucking beat. Like we had like one song that was doing pretty well. He was getting a lot of blog love and stuff like that. But somebody from Hot New Hip Hop, who is a big proponent of him early on, it's a rap website. This guy, Alex, who I think is at Atlantic now, he was working for Hot New Hip Hop and he knew Jaleel from just being in New York. And this is when Hot Boy, the Bobby Shmurda song was going absolutely crazy and Jaleel produced that. And he's like, yo, I can get a pack from Jaleel. And we're like, sure, let's hear it. And that was somewhere in it. And, it's kind of unfathomable that we got that beat at that time. and it ended up being a huge problem down the line, by the way.
Wait, why?
Because apparently after we got signed on the strength of that song, the label wanted to take it to the radio and we're like, cool, talk to Jaleel, no samples, should be good. All of a sudden it starts to chart and there's a sample in it and there's a co-producer.
Of course.
DJ Drama is associated with it or something, or Don
Cannon.
Don Cannon. Yeah, it was Don Cannon that apparently wanted points on the beat because he helped find the sample or something. We had never heard of any of this. Sample ended up eating, I think, like more than half of the song, more than half of the publishing for the song. It's actually a big sample. It's a French producer.
Oh, wow.
And when you do a deal like that with a sample in it, the sample holder in many cases has to agree to the use. And they wanted to agree on a term by term, on a case by case basis. And we had that song synced for like the triumphant, like coming out song for Rocky. This is when it was number 32 on the Hot 100.
Oh,
it was
going
to be in the biggest movie. It was going to be in like the moment in the biggest movie in the fucking country. And the rights holder of the sample wouldn't agree to the fee. It was $150,000. They wouldn't agree. They wanted to get it up. And I was like, guys, just fucking please work with us on this. We need it so bad. And they ended up, the Jean-Michel Jarre, the guy that held the sample.
It was Jean-Michel Jarre? Holy shit.
Yeah. He ended up, his publisher ended up killing that placement. And the song kind of sputtered at radio. I mean, I'm 32 on the Hot 100. It's nothing to shake a stick at, but like, I think it could have kept going. I think the song had a lot of life in it, but the sample kind of blocked us on a couple things, which is unfortunate.
Man, I mean, that just makes me think about a lot of other things we've been talking about today, man, in terms of, of leveling the playing field a bit.
Yeah. That was one of those moments. And then like just dealing with the label at a certain point. I did harbor a certain amount of the resentment towards people at the label for a while that I've now absolutely let go, because I do believe that, again, people are, I believe that people are inherently good and they wanted the best for Boogie. But it is just the way that, the labels function, the way that publicly traded companies function, is explicitly designed to extract value from workers.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The artists are the workers. And that was like, yeah, that was kind of the turning point where I was just like, I either got to fucking figure out how to save the dolphins or like, you know, figure out how to save the music industry, because
you can only pick one.
Yeah.
I just got a couple questions from people who have been listening along to just throw at you here. This is an interesting question. And I'm curious, especially given your story of how Catherine asked you if you knew what dubstep is, and you were just like, yeah, sure. So this is from Zach from Seattle. How do you feel about how Ausla artists changed the meaning and the sound of dubstep, the term, away from the original UK sound? And was that something you were aware of at the time?
I think that's a... it's a kind of a shot over the bow. I wouldn't think we had any intention of doing that. Like, we like the music. We had, you won't catch Sonny in any interview. I would know, because I've literally read every single one of them.
Yeah.
You won't ever catch him referring to his own music as dubstep. In fact, there was a moment, and I won't, there was a moment where Spin Magazine called Zed's lead single, which is absolutely decidedly not dubstep. They called it dubstep. They were so detached from reality.
Oh,
they called
it
Dead Song dubstep.
Wow.
It was like an electro, it was like a four on the floor electro house song. And I remember calling, like, me and Catherine getting on the phone with them and being like, you can't call this dubstep. This isn't dubstep. What are you talking about? And they're like, well, what do you want us to call it? And we were like, electronic dance music, call EDM. And they're like, oh, okay. And they changed it. I can't find this article, but man. I will say, I won't claim that we coined it.
It was you. You did this.
I won't claim that we coined it, but we're damn near the first people to put it in print. I will say that.
Wow.
And so, like, we made a concerted effort to not use that term internally. The thing I will also mention about all musicians that is important to keep in mind is you can't choose your fans. You have to go where you're wanted. And artists a lot of times make a huge misstep when they're like, you know, like, I don't think Sublime fans really wanted fucking dudes with like a trucker hats and fucking, you know, giant fucking pickups and All Lives Matter stickers on the bumper. They would never have been like, this is our shit. But like, you can't control that. People, you put a story out there and people gravitate towards it. Sometimes they want to call it dubstep. That has no, despite our best efforts, like, we really tried to make that not the case.
Right.
Despite our best efforts, it did kind of become the pervasive term that was used. But Sonny also, like, really became exposed to that sound in Croydon. Like, he isn't like an OG dubstep head.
Oh, you
like,
know, yeah, you already know.
Like, he loved that music and definitely, again, like, pulled influences from it. But I don't think he ever would have considered his music dubstep. I don't think he does to this day. I certainly don't. I guess I use the term because it's like this, like, kind of colloquial, like, connecting point now.
Yeah.
But, like,
just so people know what you're talking about. I mean, I know exactly what you mean, man. It's really interesting talking about the idea that, like, at a certain point you don't control it anymore. Like, it makes, like, yeah. I've had a lot of conversations with Dave Nada about Moombaton in the same way, where, you know, he started this sound and to him it was one thing. And then once it got to a certain level of popularity, like, he wasn't really in control of where it was going anymore. And at a certain point, you know, he went in a different direction.
Yeah. And you can control the music, but you can't control how people react to it. And that's, you know, a euphemism that I think is broadly applicable to life. Like, I don't know what the fucking split is, but, you know, I'm willing to say 70% action, 30% reaction.
That's a good one. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's the classic, like, you can't control other people, right? You can only control your own choices and, you know, the way you present yourself. Yeah, I completely agree, man. That's super interesting. I did not realize that Sonny's never referred to his music as dubstep. That's very interesting and actually makes a lot of sense.
Like, actively tried to not make a call that.
Yeah, which is smart. Like,
as the person that was, like, tasked with you know, protecting the narrative and creating the narrative, like, that was, we definitely fought it, but
yeah,
we can only do much.
Hey, man, you can't fight dubstep at the end of the day.
That's the title of the song on his debut album, is All Is Fair in Love and Bro Step. That was an absolutely like tongue-in-cheek reference.
All right. One more question from the chat. This is from Posey. This is a pretty general question, so feel free to interpret this in any way you want. It's just the classic. If you could do it over again, what would you do differently?
Oh man. It's a good one though.
Yeah.
I don't think I would do anything differently. Again, like I'm kind of pragmatic about these kinds of things. Like I'm really fulfilled and I'm really happy. And I think that, I think I've learned the lessons I needed to learn at the times I needed to learn them. There's one, I yelled at Boogie's A&R, like really yelled at him, in a way that was really inappropriate, that I look back on now. And I'm not proud of that. And I maybe would have done it differently, but also like, I think it was all part of the, you know, I don't know if you guys are like into quantum mechanics at all.
Oh, let's go.
I think it's really fascinating. It's like this idea. And I'm, again, like Marxism, I'm sure there's somebody here who's an armchair, right, you know, physicist that knows way more than me. But from my understanding, there is now studies that indicate that atoms can live in two states at two different times, which would imply that there can be two different realities occurring at any time. So like, I'm happy with the reality that I've, either chosen or been, lucky enough to inhabit, but also like, it's not to say necessarily that, I don't know, when you're reading the tea leaves and you're paying attention and you're in your zone. And I don't think that I don't want to say I haven't made any wrong decisions, but I think I made the decisions I was supposed to make at the time that I made them. Again, I'd probably be saying that if I had made a different decision too, just because that's just how I feel about life.
Right. But that's a good attitude to have, man. I think that's the right attitude, is that, you know, whether or not it was supposed to happen or preordained, I don't know how far down the spiritual path you go with any of that, but whether or not you buy into any of that, it's whatever happened, that was good, like at the time, you know?
Yeah. It's a convenient belief. I mean, it keeps me from fucking, you know, driving off a fucking bridge, that's for sure. I think that's the alternative.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that your one regret is one time you were mean to somebody, I think says a lot, man.
I also think I was justified in my behavior, but I think that I think a lot of people would have made the same decision, but now in retrospect, I think that I could have been more civil about it.
Yeah, well, hey, man, that's fair. I think about that kind of stuff too. It's nice, you know. And talking about Sonny and talking about being nice, like, and talking about Tim being empathetic to you, I think that's like a theme in all of this, right? Is that it's actually somewhat rare to find true, nice, caring people in this business of what we do. And if any of us on any side of the business can put more of that out there, I think that's really going to be a net positive at the end of the day.
Give people good times is always the slogan.
I love that, man. Well, this has been really fun, man. I wasn't sure exactly where this conversation was going to go because you're much harder to research than a lot of people I talk to on here.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank God.
Yeah. Although I will say, I don't know if you know this. If you Google your name, one of the first things that comes up is your IMDb page.
I have heard that. Yeah, yeah. I co-produced a show for Facebook Watch a couple of years ago. It's a cooking show starring Miguel. So that's really great. Funny.
Yeah. It's,
I mean, I'm still a partner in the production company. So inevitably, there will be more additions to that page, but I'm completely inactive in it now. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure I got my hands in a lot of pots.
Well, yeah, yeah. I was going to start wrapping it up by asking you, is there anything we haven't talked about? Anything else you're involved in right now, or even something you're not involved in that you're just excited about? Anything you got your eyes on?
I'm excited about, not excited, but I'm concerned with the global water shortage that's impending. I am concerned with the sustainability of ocean plastics. And I do have some exposure to those kinds of things. I work with a company called Cove. I'm an advisor who made the world's first 100% biodegradable bottle of water. I'm really proud of that. And I'm excited to kind of do more there. I don't know. I think that if I wasn't in music, I'd be working in sustainability in some capacity. So I read a lot about that kind of thing. I really don't think that I work in music anymore.
I don't know.
I do work with musicians.
You work adjacent to music, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely. I do work with music. I still manage Matt. And I love that. I get to have some, you know, a couple toes in the traditional industry, just to keep learning about it. But yeah, that's about it.
I mean, what does your day look like? Like you're involved in a whole bunch of different ventures. You have varied interests. I mean, is there such a thing as like a typical work day for you?
Totally. I mean, finally. Yeah. I mean, like Audius, I started in Audius as a contractor. When it went full time, it became far more than full time. And it is by far it consumes the gross majority of my time and my attention.
Yeah.
I'm lucky to have had a career where I met a lot of cool people that people want to talk to. So my exposure to anything outside of Audius is really just kind of relationship based and investing. Like I'm also really lucky to have had a good couple of years. So I've been able to diversify a little bit and, you know, spread that out. And I advise and invest in a couple of things, but I'm not really active in anything but Audius and Matt Mason right now. Just because, and those two are the same thing to me. Like Matt is, an artist that I believe is an affront to a lot of the things that I dislike about the music industry. And his music and his storytelling resonates with me in a way that no one else's does. Mm. And so I look to create better systems outside of the traditional ones so that I can eventually hyper serve people like him and him personally.
What do you mean when you say, you know, what he does is an affront or goes against a lot of the conventional industry right now?
Just in terms of the fact that like he is very deliberate about his songwriting and the personal nature of his music and what it means to him and what it can mean to other people. Mm. The music just generally isn't personal right now, in many cases, at least in terms of like people that are in his lane. He's a singer-songwriter, but like he has crossover songs. Like he's got 2 gold records. People that achieve those kinds of things in many cases are not intimately recorded or not intimately involved with the creation of the story behind those songs.
Right.
It's kind of like, and Matt is just, that is, will never be something that Matt does. He will die poor before he lets somebody else write a lyric for him, basically.
Yeah. Going back to like how Ausla was never about making money, man, I feel like that must be an ethos that you're attracted to in some way.
Yeah. I'm attracted to the idea of sustainability across everything. Not to say the music industry right now isn't sustainable. It's just not sustainable for most people. I think the idea of scaling down wealth is something that I'm very, very obsessed with. Not to say that I don't like being comfortable and having, you know, being compensated for the work that I do and the work that I've done for many years. But I also don't think anybody needs to be a billionaire. And I don't think anybody needs to be at the top of every playlist for the same reasons.
Yeah. Amen. Well, last little thing before I let you go. Earlier you said that I don't think there needs to be billionaires. And I also don't think there needs to be Drakes or Taylor Swifts, which I was wondering, like in your, I don't know if you have an idyllic vision of like what the perfect system would look like, but does the existence of pop stars, does that go against the idea of like equality for artists?
I think so, because attention is a commodity. And though our attention, we don't make our own decisions online, whether you like to think so or not, like we don't. Like, and so the centralization of our attention towards certain pillars of creativity, I do think is a product of platforms, not necessarily of people. I'm a fucking huge Drake fan, by the way. Like huge Drake fan, like full stan. But that said, like a lot of people aren't and still listen to his music because it's there and it's accessible and it's just what it is.
Right.
And, I mean, Taylor Swift, I won't get into that because I don't need the Taylor stans. She's phenomenal.
We're not talking about the artists themselves.
We're not talking about the artists. We're talking about the ways that fans find them. Right.
Yeah.
I don't think that anybody needs to be as popular as Taylor Swift, because I think that there's 100 other people that are maybe not equally, but also have a different perspective or have a different style of songwriting, who also have ideas that are valid and should be considered, and will never be, because they weren't at the right place at the right time with the right amount of data supporting the right algorithm.
Man, I've never thought about pop stars as billionaires like that corollary, but that's actually pretty spot on. That's really interesting.
Thanks, man. Yeah. I think about this stuff way too much.
No, that's a banger, man. You got to push that.
Thanks for letting me work on it.
Oh, dude, absolutely. Thank you for doing this, man. It's really nice to just catch up with you. Like, I feel like we're connected because I see you on social media all the time. But when I thought about it, I was like, I actually haven't actually talked to that guy in a long time.
I know. I was psyched. Like, I don't think that DM sat in my box for more than 15 seconds.
Yeah, you were super quick. I was stoked too, man.
Well, appreciate you. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, dude, thank you. And so this is the last question that I ask at the end of each one of these interviews. It's kind of just like first thing that pops into your head kind of question. Just looking for a time in your life, a memory, a moment. It could be from any time when in that single moment, music really deeply affected you, had a deep impact on you in that moment.
Easy. As I mentioned, I was really obsessed with like living in a city when I was a little kid. My mom had a really cool friend who was much younger than her. Who lived in Seattle, and there's a music festival in Seattle called Bumbershoot. When I was 13, my mom let me travel from Boise to Seattle with my best friend, which is like...
That's crazy.
Yeah, kind of pretty crazy. And we were staying with her, and I now realize her apartment smelled like weed. I probably realized it then, but also just didn't mention that to my mom. She played Steely Dan's Asia for us in her Volkswagen, or in her Volvo. When she was driving us somewhere, she played Steely Dan's Asia and the first note of Black Cow, which is the first song on that album, which is my favorite album of all time by any artist ever. I remember being like, holy shit, this is, and I just like, it was like this consummate experience where it was raining. I was in this beautiful city that I'd never been to. I had like this sense of freedom because I never really traveled that far from home alone before. That will always be one of my favorite musical memories.
That's incredible, man. Because that's what it is, right? It's like the soundtrack to the important moments in our development. Like there's nothing more powerful than that. And I feel like all we do is really chase after that feeling in our adult life.
It definitely goes away. But then we have the opportunity to provide it for other people, hopefully. So
yeah, absolutely, man. I think that's, you know, to sustain any kind of long career, I mean, really in any business, but anything creative for sure, that's what it is, right? It's almost like the sampling thing from earlier. You just gotta like flip your perspective on it a little bit and find a new way to say something about it, find a new way to enjoy it for yourself, any of that.
Yeah, man, definitely. It comes from different sources. You get those moments from different things as you grow older too. And I think like, I don't know, I don't really know if I can think of an analogy for like my current state of adulthood. I think for a lot of people, it's probably having a kid is like the ultimate moment. So who knows?
Yeah. Hey, do you ever see that in your future?
I feel like this whole world is going to go up in fucking flames.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know. I don't plan on planning it. I'll put it that way.
I like that, man. I mean, it seems like that's, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that's the way you've sort of operated in a lot of different parts of your life.
Yeah, that'll be the biggest dice roll. Exactly.
I love it, man. Well, this has been really good, man. I really enjoyed catching up with you, man. This has been great to chat.
Likewise, man. Thank you again for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you, dude. Have a great rest of your day.
See you soon.
All right. Peace.